I have maybe a couple of announcements. One is that maybe some of you have seen already that there's a sign on our donation boxes by the door that says that all the donations that are put in the box today, on both sides of the box, will be donated further on to Second Harvest. And it seemed like a small thing that our IMC community could do in wake of the destruction of the hurricane, to try to offer a little bit to help. And we did a little bit of research to see what would be the best place to send the money. And Second Harvest, American Second Harvest, seemed like a very good candidate. Any of you would like to make a donation today, anything you donate today, especially if you'd like to donate more today, because it's a nice vehicle to have it pass on. And it feels kind of nice to have it also come out of a Buddhist group, this kind of organization also would be represents the kind of response that happens all over America in churches and synagogues and mosques, in order to respond as a way of helping. It seems in a few weeks, on Friday, September 16th, Friday evening, we have we organized a benefit here at IMC for tsunami relief. Our thought was that we gave some thought back in January and February how us as a community could respond to the destructions that happened in South Asia last January with tsunami. This was our idea, was to wait, rather than kind of rushing at the moment, to wait maybe 8-9 months, and when kind of everyone else forgets about what's happened there, and when there's a huge need still to rebuilding and all that, and then have a benefit and try to make our efforts later rather than right away as an organization. So we've invited Joanna Macy, who is amazing, a Buddhist teacher and activist, one of the preeminent, kind of one of the elders of the American kind of Buddhist community, and to come and do a benefit for Sri Lanka, for a particular organization in Sri Lanka named Sarvodaya. And Sarvodaya it's kind of like a grassroots Gandhi-like movement. It's been going on now, I don't know for how long, 50 years or so in Sri Lanka. And they do a tremendous amount of work in the villages, tens of thousands of villages or so in Sri Lanka, to develop a kind of self-help, kind of develop their villages and their lives and their well-being. And among the many things that Joanna Macy's done is she has actually been there to Sri Lanka to work with them and studied them and wrote about them quite extensively. And it seems like a great privilege to have Joanna come and talk at our center. And she's done so many wonderful things, and great teacher and writer of Buddhism. And now it seems a little bit awkward to have our focus on the tsunami relief, when here in America we have this huge similar kind of catastrophe happening here. But that's the way it is, you know. That's the part of the nature of the world, is that it's unpredictable. It doesn't go according to plan, right? We have a plan. But we'll continue with that, doing that benefit for South Asia, and perhaps we can think of the whole world as a big family, and the need is still just as great there as it was before the hurricane. And that maybe we can think about doing something in 9 months also, when it's kind of some of the focus of the damage in Louisiana and Mississippi has kind of lightened. Perhaps we could do some similar kind of benefit in our community here. After 9/11, on 9/13, we were still back in Palo Alto. We had a gathering of our community, and a lot of people came, but the room was packed, in order to have some way of dealing, responding, processing 9/11. And it was quite a moving, and for some of you, I think very significant gathering. And we didn't do much except pass the mic around. Because we didn't have a mic, but we just people just talked, spoke up and talked. And it was, the talking was set up in such a way that this was not the time to assign blame. And some people were just chomping at the bit, ready to be angry and assign blame left and right, and get make political statements. And it didn't seem appropriate in 9/11 to do that, but rather right afterwards, I mean, in the wake, 2 days later. And so people got up and spoke about how they felt, what their feelings were, and their fears, their frustrations, their angers, much more immediately how it actually was. And it felt like a very significant meeting, and I think it helped a lot of people kind of come to terms with what had happened. And I feel like a lot of people have been watching the news and television images and getting a sense of the immensity of the damaged, and there's a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions, a lot of strong things that have happened right here in the United States, and certainly in our community as well. And what I'd like to do today is a little bit different. I don't think I'll kind of just open right now up to the same kind of processing as we did now then, but I'd like to give a talk on this little bit my kind of attempt to respond to, or my reflections on the response, or Buddhist response to this kind of phenomena. And hopefully that's okay, suits everyone. I think that one of the first, or primary perhaps, Buddhist approaches to any kind of catastrophe, whether it's Katrina or this Kepler books closes, which for some people is a big shock, or this week I went and sat at the bedside of a friend who was admitted to hospice, who's dying and removed from his life support and will fade away over the next few days. I think one of the first responses is a little bit counterintuitive to kind of maybe the Western cultural mind. So I'll say it and then explain why I think it's the first Buddhist response. And one of the first responses is to take refuge, and in particular, take refuge in the Dharma. And why this might seem counterintuitive to a Western mind is it might seem that when there's a disaster or a catastrophe, the focus should be outside, should be in helping, doing something. And taking refuge seems something almost passive. You kind of take refuge, you kind of fall back on something that's going to support you or help you. But I don't think that's what's meant in by taking refuge. There is an interesting phenomena in the West, among Westerners, many people that I've seen, where when we look at, we're very interested in having an interpretation or understanding or evaluation of the world, of reality. And what's the nature of reality? What's the nature of this world we live in? And coming out of kind of the Torah and the Bible and Book of Genesis, there is a, after God supposedly made the world, he's supposed to have asked the question or made an analysis, oh, it's good. It's good what I made. And so there's been this idea in the West that you can evaluate the world as being a good place. And some people then take exception to that and say, well, actually, it's not so good. It's a bad place. And after the Holocaust, there was a lot of people, for example, who felt very discouraged with theology, God, because how could this happen? And I've, in many different small ways and big ways, people have sometimes had life happen to them in devastating ways. And they've had to question their idea, is the world a good place? The Buddhist idea is not to ask that question. It's not concerned with the analysis of whether the world is a good place or a bad place, but rather to let the world be as it is and not get tied ourselves up in that kind of question. But rather than asking that kind of question, the idea in Buddhism is to focus on where we can make a difference. Where can we make the most difference? And the most difference is said to be in ourselves, the choices we make, the actions we do. And to borrow from one of my favorite theistic stories, a man died and went to heaven. And found God and started complaining. You know, the world is a terrible place. All this war, devastation, hurricanes, all these people die, children die. It's just, you know, these terrible things happen in the world. Why don't you do something? And then God looks at him and says, I did do something. I made you. So the idea of, you know, how we respond becomes very important. Maybe that's how we refine God. That's where we find the Dharma. So in Buddhism, the idea of how we are becomes very important. In a sense, each of us is the center of the universe. Each of us is the beginning place where this whole universe radiates out from us. The universe of our experience, the universe of our perception. The universe that we can have an impact on and experience. So how are we with that universe? How are we sitting in that center of that universe? How do we respond? How do we react? What do we do with it? And one of the things Buddhists do is they take refuge. And in particular, taking refuge in the Dharma. And what refuge means here is to rely on, to find inspiration in, and to find protection from. So these are in, find protection in, inspiration in, and rely in, these things. So usually we talk about refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But in taking refuge in the Dharma, we understand the Dharma is three things. And I have to understand that it's there's many ways of describing Dharma, but here, refuge, I think, is, I see it as three things. It's refuge in the three aspects of Dharma, which is classically called Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, which is a virtue, our inner development, our inner spiritual life, and then our understanding or our wisdom. And so how does this play out, you know, with the disaster, with catastrophe of any kind? The first, usually people start with their analysis by looking at the wisdom or understanding, certain level of understanding. And one of the very common understandings of Buddhism is the understanding that that the world in some way, inherent in the world that we experience, inherent in this world, is the experience is a certain degree of unreliability, of unsatisfactoriness, that we can't rely on the world to unfold according to our plans and our wishes and our desires. There's a certain degree in which the world is unreliable, that if we kind of depend on the world to be a certain way, reality to be a certain way, our bodies to be a certain way, our minds to be a certain way, that any kind of dependence is not going to be ultimately reliable. And this is kind of built into the whole Buddhist kind of view of human life. And what it lends itself to, ideally, is not to be weighed down by this understanding, but actually be buoyed by it, be lightened by it. It's kind of like, you know, expecting things to go wrong, expecting that things are not going to work, as opposed to expecting they are going to work. When we expect they are going to work, then we're disappointed when they don't work. When we expect them not to work, then it's a surprise. Well, look at that, it worked. There's a famous story of Ajahn Chah. People noticed apparently that he had a teacup that was his favorite teacup. A little, I guess, a ceramic cup. And someone asked him, you know, how could you, a great, you know, enlightened, you know, Buddhist teacher and master, how could you have your favorite cup? How can you have this attachment? And he said, when I look at this cup, I already see that it's broken. So I'm sure he treated respect and care, and, you know, but he's already kind of expects it to break. It already, that's kind of built into the whole system. So he appreciates it and enjoys it, you know, he's not attached to it. He expects it. If it disappears, that's what he expects. That's the nature, what happens. In countries like Thailand, if someone leaves IMC, a place like IMC, and finds that their tire is flat, or all four tires are flat, they might be disappointed in various things, but one of the common responses would be, oh, anicca, impermanence. That's how things are, they're impermanent. Who expected them to be any different? So things are impermanent. So deep understanding it kind of brings a kind of lightness to it. And Rana Kabatsnik, who went to the beaches of Thailand where the tsunami hit, right afterwards and helped, she reported about how amazing it was to see the ease, or the certain kind of a lightness that the Thai people had, the Thai Buddhists had, as opposed to the Westerners around what had just happened to them. So kind of a little bit different attitude, different kind of approach. I'm sure they were devastated, and it was a lot of pain for the Thais, but there was somehow the notion that, anicca, impermanence, unreliability, helps people be lighter about their life rather than heavier. And maybe that's a little bit hard for Westerners to understand, where the idea of things being unreliable kind of depresses us. But we begin by this kind of understanding. And one of the reflections that Buddhists will often do, or encouraged to do, is reflections like this. Everyone has a nature of aging. I am not free of aging. Everyone has a nature of getting sick. I am not free of being susceptible to being sick. Everyone has a nature of dying. I am not free of death. Death will happen to me. So that everyone, kind of this very common kind of sickness, old age, and death is built into the experience of being a human being. And that there's a level of equanimity and sense of importance that comes from really recognizing and then seeing that. And the sense of importance is called samvega, a sense of urgency. It sounds like, yeah, I got to look at this and face this and look at this. This is really important to see this, even though it might make me a little bit lighter, a little bit easier, not expecting things to work out. I also have to take this seriously and say, okay, I have to look at these things, and this is my chance to clarify the spiritual life. This is my chance to work with my reactions and responses and find the freedom, find the spiritual life. So to take refuge in the Dharma is partly to take refuge in an understanding that is not holding on to the world as being good or bad, but seeing that the experience of the world is unreliable and is impermanent, and that our response and reactions to that is at the heart of the spiritual life. So then there comes a second aspect of Dharma, which is samadhi. And samadhi has to do with bhavana, which means development, cultivation, the inner cultivation, the cultivation of the inner heart, the mind, the inner life, the spiritual life. And Buddhism puts tremendous importance on cultivating and developing the inner life. And there's different aspects to that. And one aspect has to do with looking very honestly at how we tend to react, how we react to different situations. And so how do we react? What's our responses? What's our reactions? So when there's anger, to really look at the anger very carefully. When there's anger, it's very easy for people to look at where we, the object of anger, the place we're angry at, where we assign blame. And in being blinded by the anger, not seeing what it's like for us to be, or the caughtness, the way we're caught up when we get angry. Anger has tends to put blinders on people. It doesn't have to, but more often than not, put blinders, and we see selectively. So to look at our anger, understand that, and turn the attention around to really understand what's going on here with me. There's a whole universe behind the facade of anger, and so to turn the attention back in, you might notice some of that universe of maybe the anger arises out of deep pain, maybe the anger arises out of fear, maybe the anger arises out of despair, or frustration, or grief. And so sometimes it's more useful to open to that inner universe that anger is just the kind of the front for. Or there might be the primary reaction is one of hopelessness, or the one of despair, or the one of grief. And it might be, those emotions might be held in such a way that they depress us, that they somehow drain us, they diminish us, they kind of limit us, they kind of make us sometimes numb, sometimes feeling of hiding, withdrawing, or lashing out, different responses to it. But what is our reaction? And Buddhist practice puts tremendous importance in taking responsibility of our reactions. Stop and look. What's going on for you? And do it really honestly. And the skills of mindfulness is meant to help us be very honest with what's going on inside of us. The other side of samadhi, of this inner development, is then based on what we see, and then to see what is it that needs to be developed, what needs to be strengthened and developed. And we sometimes make a distinction between a reaction and a response. What in response to what we see, our reactions, How do we develop ourselves? And we don't leave our inner life to chance. We don't leave the degree to our spiritual growth, our emotional growth to chance. So can we develop our capacity for compassion? Can we develop our capacity for equanimity, for being at peace? Can we develop our capacity to stay calm? Can we develop our capacity to be generous? Can we develop our capacity for loving kindness? Can we develop our capacity to see clearly? It's a whole thing to learn how to see clearly. And so Buddha says, yes, you can do that. You can develop all these things. And it's really worthwhile to spend time doing that. And so Buddha's spiritual life has to do with, in various ways, trying to develop these wonderful qualities of who we are. So they become not just potentials that we have, but become strengths that we carry with us. And those strengths become the strengths that we then carry into the world. So having an ongoing meditation practice, an ongoing spiritual practice of some kind or other, becomes really important in order to develop these qualities. Many years ago, I was very impressed by one of the chapters in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi's book on Zen, where he said something like, if you find yourself in a time of crisis and you haven't done any spiritual work before that, then you're not going to have the resources available in order to respond or deal with a situation in a wise way. Yet you need to kind of build the momentum. You know, when things are going basically pretty well, then you need to kind of develop your capacity for stability, concentration, for mindfulness, for compassion, for all the different qualities we develop in meditation practice. You need to develop those. And don't just wait until the disaster strikes in order to develop them. You have to build a reservoir, build those resources. And then when a crisis occurs, those become available. And I've known many people who were very grateful for their ability to develop meditative calm, because in a time of crisis, they were able to stay calm. And calm is one of the great, it's a great, great help to the world. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese teacher, tells a story. He was very much involved with helping the Vietnamese boat people in the 70s and 80s. And it was a huge problem. They were attacked by pirates. They were, besieged by great storms at sea, and these huge boats laden with refugees. And he said, you know, sometimes the boats would be packed with people, and they just above the waterline, the top of the boat. And so, a big wave would come along and just wash over the boat, and everyone would drown. And he said that Thich Nhat Hanh claimed that if one person in the boat could stay calm, it helped everybody. You know, if there was a crisis, if a big wave came or something, if one person could stay calm, everyone else kind of somehow had that as a reference point and maybe could stay calmer also. So calm is often a great gift. Ability to stay calm in the midst, rather than agitated, rather than running around. It's a great aid, great help. This woman, this friend I visited this week who's dying, she was tired. And when I came to her room, she was sleeping, and she was tired, and she talked about being tired. Each day she was getting more and more tired. And she talked about how visitors drained her, made it really tired for her. And so, I sat there. We had silence periods. We talked for a while, and didn't say much. And after a while, I said, maybe I should go now. I don't want to tire you out. I know you have more visitors later. And she said, no, it's not tiring talking to you. And then she told me how some of the people the day before were exhausting for her. The way they talked, their agitation, their concern, their fear, all this kind of way they were. And it was really hard for her to be. She actually had to send some people away. And it was very, people come to say their final goodbye and she's chewing them out. So sometimes it's really helpful to have the capacity to be calm so we can help people. So take refuge in the Dharma then also is take refuge in a practice, practicing ourselves. And so this is where actually the action comes into place, where a Buddhist practice involves doing something, not just being passive, but actually engaging then in clarifying our own hearts and working on our own hearts. And it's an endless, seemingly endless task, and no amount of Buddhist practice, I would say, I'm not going to no amount of spiritual practice is ever wasted. No amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. So a moment of mindfulness, a moment of concentration, a moment of compassion, a moment of loving kindness, all bears fruit. So then comes the third aspect of taking refuge in the Dharma. And the third aspect is called virtue, or sila. And sometimes it's people think it only has to do with precepts. You know, if the five precepts, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, no sexual misconduct, and no intoxicating the mind. But that's a kind of very narrow aspect of what sila is. Sila means virtue, and it has to do with the way that we act in the world, acting from a place of the purity of heart. And this becomes very important. This is part of where we engage in the world, we act in the world. So Dharma has to do with action in the world as well as this inner work that we do. Some people put too much emphasis on the inner world. Some people put too much emphasis on action in the world. Ideally, for Buddhists, we find just the right balance. It's right for each individual person of balancing the action in the world with the inner world of inner development. So sila has to do with things like generosity and compassion, how we engage in the world. And generosity is then the response to something like Katrina, to the disaster, the devastation of it. We have to act. We have to do something. And can we, once we clarify how we are feeling, what's going on inside of us, and once we can clarify that we can come from the best purity of heart that we can, then what is the most appropriate response for us given the situation? And we have to act. I believe, and I said this after 9/11, that when certain kind of things happen in the world, if we don't allow those things to change us, we kind of disrespect the power of what had just happened. We do kind of violence to ourselves. So in 9/11, if we didn't allow 9/11 somehow to change who we are, I think that you know, we only spend our time blaming other people or something, or when expecting other people to do something, then I think it actually does a kind of spiritual violence to our own hearts to just leave it like that. But to let something like 9/11 change us, so we're changed as a result of that. It could be a very small change, but maybe a little change of direction that we take our life, or a change of interest, or maybe a change in our inspiration or dedication, a resolve to somehow help our neighbors, to somehow develop a spiritual life, to somehow you know, do something. You know, he'll just help with a neighbor next door who needs help with shopping a little bit. It could be that small, but somehow to be changed by it. So the same thing with something like what happens with Katrina or the tsunami. To be a human being, I think, and to be sensitive and awake and aware to what happens to our fellow family members in the world, the whole world's a family, then how do we allow ourselves to be changed? How do we reflect on this? How do we consider it so that we don't just expect other people to take care of things, but how do we reflect on it so, you know, how do I want to be different based on that? And again, there's many, many, many different responses for that. Some are directly having to do with what happened in New Orleans. And some people maybe will choose never to respond directly to New Orleans, but will do other things. Okay, I'm inspired. I'm going to redouble my efforts for the tsunami people. I'm going to redouble my efforts for my local community, because that's where I have the inspiration to put my work. But I'm inspired, I'm moved. I've been moved by New Orleans. And because I'm moved, I'm going to channel and try to make a difference here. And one of the things that impressed me this week reading in the paper was that some years ago there was a study about the three major potential disasters that could affect the United States in the next years or whatever. And one of them was a terrorist attack. Another one, the second one, was a hurricane hitting New Orleans. And the third is an earthquake in California. And when I thought earthquake in California, I thought, oh, there's a very good chance they're talking about 2 miles from here. With the San Andreas Fault, you know, just a short way from here. And so, you know, now it's New Orleans. New Orleans could be us. And so, you know, if that reminds us, oh, it could be us, So it's not just simply a matter of those people out there, but it's also us. It's the whole human family. And so how do we want to respond? Maybe we wanted to kind of respond here to what goes on here in some immediate way. But to somehow let the goodness of our heart respond. To be honest, to have an understanding that contextualizes it all. To clarify our own hearts, to work on our own hearts. And then to respond are the three aspects of Dharma. And I would like to suggest that those three aspects are inseparable from each other. So when we take refuge in the Dharma, it's not a passive thing. It's not a childish thing of kind of relying on a parent. It's actually a very grown-up thing, because it actually is that which is going to help us step forward and act in the world in a responsible and clear and generous way. So take refuge in the Dharma. And I think my idea of saying this today is that for me, and I think for many people, to be reminded that Buddhists have this resource. That this is a resource, or this is a place that Buddhists go in times of confusion, or they go in times of difficulty. They can go to the Dharma. And the greater the difficulty, the more the Dharma is the resource. In fact, when everything else is impossible, the Dharma is still there, is available. So when I was talking to my friend who's dying, we spent time together at Tassajara, a Zen monastery. And so I started talking to her about meditating at the Tassajara Zen monastery. She spent a few years there meditating in the meditation hall there. And what was that like, you know, to meditate? And she talked about how, I sat hour after hour, day after day, month after month. She said, I was sitting. You sit and sit and sit. And then at some point, something just dropped. Everything kind of drops away. And there's tremendous peace in space that was available there. And as she was remembering this and talking about this, it was really obvious that that experience of things dropping, the experience of her spiritual life, of meditating, was one of her primary references and resources for her as she was dying. And I could feel the kind of level of kind of spaciousness and peace around her, certainly as she talked about it, but also just even before she talked about it. That's what it comes from those years of practice she's done. So taking refuge in the Dharma is to take refuge in our practice, our understanding, and our actions, our response. And we have to respond. And the last thing I'll say is that in the honesty of looking at our reactions, for Buddhist practice, anything goes. You're allowed to react any way you want. You're not necessarily supposed to act on any reaction, but your reactions are respected. Your reactions are respected, your feelings, your anger, your despair, everything's respected. Everything has a place in the practice, and we allow it to come, and then we try to clarify our lives and our hearts based on that honesty of seeing what's there without apology. So that's my thoughts about this morning. I hope that they were suitable or adequate or appropriate for this big event that's struck the United States. I hope that in the long term, I hope that something like this just brings out the best in all of us. So now it's your turn. Is anyone who wants to say anything or respond or talk about how they're feeling or anything?
I've been trying to formulate a little question, and your very last sentence actually is a perfect segue to my question. And that's to reflect on what has been reported anyway as bringing out the worst in quite a few people in the community there, and especially in light of the idea that bringing this home, that this could happen right here. How can we prepare our community to react so that it brings the best out rather
than here
or there, or any reflections you have on that whole aspect of this disaster?
Uh-huh. I mean, I don't know what to say, but the first thing that comes to mind is that my guess is for every report of the worst coming out of people, there's probably dozens of cases where the best came out of people, and somehow the worst tends to get greater press. And maybe it's right to get great press. I'm not saying it's wrong, but there's always a tremendous amount of good happening also all across the country. I think this, the wisdom side, the understanding side of all this, is to understand, yes, of course, we're going to have the worst coming out of people also. So there's some understanding. We don't expect it to be any different, of course, in some ways. And then given that's what's happening, how do we respond? How do we deal with that? But your question is, how do we take care of our community here so that, you know, there's a big earthquake or something happens here? How do we... I don't have any obvious answer. I mean, there's certainly the spiritual practice I would hope would help. Voting appropriately, I think, probably would help. And since elected officials have things, you know, have some responsibility in all this. There's all kinds of local movements, helping the local communities and volunteering and working in different ways. I know there's a movement in the United States called Restorative Justice. And there's some people here locally involved in that. And it takes different forms, but one of the ideas is rather than when someone does a crime in the local community, rather than taking to court and going through the judge and jail whole thing, the whole usual thing, is you bring together the whole community that was affected by that crime. So the victims of the crime, their family members, the family members of the person who did the crime, and you bring everyone together and you have a council, you have a meeting, everyone together, and everyone has a chance to talk. And by the time they finished talking, if this goes well and the person's open, to some degree open, then the person has understood what they've done, how they've created a rupture, a tear in the fabric of their community. And they're held accountable in a way that's very different than if you get sent to jail. And so it's called restorative justice. And somehow you change the person's heart to kind of create the crime. And some communities have had a lot of luck with that. So somehow creating a culture where the way that we treat each other is one of respect and getting the best out of people. But it takes effort to do that. So everyone has to make their part to do that. And if we're just expecting other people, if we're always expecting other people to do things, then probably nothing will happen. But if we take some responsibility ourselves, I think that's the emphasis in the Dharma is in Buddhism, is that of course other people, we can vote and for all kinds of things and expect other people to do things. But I think the default of the Dharma is always to look in what can I do? What's my responsibility? The first place to look is what can I do to make a difference, rather than what could other people do. So I don't know if that's an adequate answer, but it was an answer. Is that okay for now?
Well, I'm sure the people who are trapped down there felt abandoned by everybody, but the whole world was watching, and I think for millions of people it makes us feel more connected to those people, and I'm hoping that in the future that the people who are trapped find out that they are connected to other people and that other people will continue to try to be involved and do something.
I think so too. And some people feel abandoned now, and then for a short period they'll feel connected and helped, and then in a few months they'll feel abandoned again because, you know, the focus is off then. So I hope that also that it's important to keep these things in mind and remember. So I'm hoping that, you know, I was really happy that I know Joanna Macy, and we had that connection to invite her to come and help with the tsunami benefit here. And I hope that in maybe 8-9 months, that as a community, something will arise in our community with some great idea, will crystallize. A wonderful idea that makes sense for us to do something like a benefit or do something at a time when maybe 9 months when maybe the focus has gone off. Okay, so I hope that in taking refuge in the Dharma, that it means that it points to the best in each of us. Thank you.
Thank you.